طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with some disturbing stories out of Palestine. Israel continues to turn the screws of military occupation against the Palestinian people. They seem to get away with everything, and their cruelty seems to know no bounds, even when it comes to offending international communities by destroying projects funded by them. Their strategy of making life unbearable so that the Palestinians will somehow leave their land has been, is, and will continue to be a colossal failure. In fact, under incredible duress, the Palestinian population is increasing while the Jewish population is diminishing throughout historic Palestine. But Israel wants the land, is taking the land, and we not only do nothing about it, we fund it. We begin with a story out of Bethlehem, the destruction of a brand new internationally funded school the day before school started. Here's how the story was reported by Shireen Kalel in Mondo Weiss. Israeli military jeeps came barreling down towards Jubet al-Dib's first and only primary school late Tuesday night, terrifying locals who had been finishing preparation for the school's grand opening set for the next morning. Soldiers shot tear gas and rubber-coated bullets as they cleared the way for bulldozers and flatbed trucks brought in to take the school. The school, located between four Palestinian villages on the outskirts of Bethlehem, was built with caravans on a concrete foundation by local authorities and international NGOs partnered with the European Union, hoping to mitigate the myriad of challenges facing students in the area. Israeli students quickly cleared the area with crowd control weapons, and within an hour of the soldiers' arrival, the caravans had been loaded up and taken away, along with the tables, desks, construction equipment, and everything else other than the concrete foundation, bathrooms, and tiny chairs brought for the 7 to 9 year olds that were expected to attend their first day of school the next morning. The only other schools in the area, Hattin Primary and Secondary Schools for Boys and Girls, located in the middle of Tamara Village, on the outskirts of Bethlehem City, is actually a shoddily refurbished home rented by the Palestinian Authority to serve the children of four local villages. The landlord lives in a home on the upper floor. If it was not for the faded cartoon paintings etched along the wall of Hattin School, one might think they were passing a car garage instead of a main educational institution in the area. The front of the school opens to three large garage-like doors. Each door takes up an entire wall of each room, leaving the children's cramped classrooms exposed to the main street some meters away. In the first room, boys and girls sat nearly shoulder to shoulder on their very first day of kindergarten. These children live closest to the school, so they were given priority to attend class there. The rest of the children from the surrounding villages have to travel up to 6 miles away. There are no school buses, and many people living in the rural village, not connected to electric grids or main water lines, have no means of transportation and little money to afford daily trips to and from the school, leaving most of the children with no other choice but to walk. The classrooms are not anywhere near large enough to hold the students it serves, which is only a small fraction of the children in the community. Standing inside one of the classrooms in the basement of the home-turned school, the principal explained that 20 students were supposed to be taught in that tiny room. It is too hard to study in this kind of room. It makes it so the students aren't able to focus very well because they look at the conditions, she said, motioning to the small room around her, whose peeling walls were decorated from floor to ceiling in art projects made by the children, an attempt to brighten the dreary room. The new school, which would have served more than 60 children, was built to help relieve the situation for the students, but while the old school is located in Area B under joint Palestinian-Israeli control, the new school was located in Area C, which falls under full Israeli control. Any construction in Area C, which comprises more than 60% of the West Bank, requires a building permit, 98.5% of which are denied. The European Union and the Palestinian Authority had hoped to get the school approved retroactively, as the two bodies have been pressuring Israeli authorities to approve a master plan for the villages, which would also allow them to be hooked up to electricity grids, water mains, garbage facilities, and more. A Palestinian employee with one of the NGOs involved in the project, who asked to remain anonymous, told Mondo Weiss that building the school in Area C was a calculated plan. We are persuading the planning regime, the employee explained, referring to the pressure put on Israel to approve the master plan. We can't leave Area C. This is the Palestinian Authority and the European Union's policy. Otherwise, it'll be confiscated later for settlement expansion. Having a school in Area C is a way to further support a master plan and to convince the community not to leave. A spokesperson with the Israelis' Coordination for Government Activities in the Territories, the body charged with administering the occupied West Bank, said the school was confiscated after stop orders were issued days previously. However, local activists said stop work orders were only issued to the concrete bathrooms built next to the caravans. The bathrooms were left, while the caravans were confiscated. Palestinian children sit and wait on the remains of their school that was destroyed by the Israeli forces as activists set up a tent for teachers to conduct classes in that day. The morning after the confiscation, the children still came. All 64 students who expected to start class at their new school gathered on the barren concrete foundation as part of a symbolic protest. The children sang the national anthem to politicians, activists, parents, and teachers before receiving brand new backpacks to take home with them. For their second day of school, some of the children will return to the dilapidated school in the village, while most will continue taking the long walk to schools in other areas, where they are treated differently and made fun of, both from being from a rural area and from often showing up late in sweaty, dirty clothes from the long walk. While very young, the children told Mondo Weiss they understood very well what was happening around them. We came to school and found the school destroyed, one young boy said. It's the first day of school, and we are just sad because the soldiers took our hope. That was an article from the news service Mondo Weiss, describing the Israeli destruction of a brand new school for Palestinian children the day before the new semester began. Our next story involves the outrageous arrest of one of the most beloved activists working in the very dangerous area of Hebron, perhaps the most active area of settler violence. It is yet another example of the collaboration of the Palestinian Authority with the Israeli military. Indeed, the PA has become an arm of the occupation. Here is Monda Weiss's account of that incident. Palestinian forces arrested Palestinian peace activist Issa Amro for the Facebook post he published condemning the Palestinian Authority for detaining journalist and radio director Ayman Kouazmi the day previously. Kouazmi was detained by the PA days after Israeli forces raided and shut down Freedom Radio in Hebron on accusations of, quote, incitement. Immediately following the forced closure of the station, Kouazmi took to social media, blasting the PA for being unable to protect its citizens and calling for Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah, as well as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Hebron Mayor Kamel Hamed, to resign. This is happening in front of you. My message to President Mahmoud Abbas, Prime Minister Rami El Hamdallah, Hebron Governor Kamel Hamed, and other officials is to submit their resignations and stay at home, because they are unable to protect the media in Palestine. His statement read, translated into English by the International Middle East Media Center. This media network is in an area that is under the complete control of the Palestinian Authority, yet they remain silent and cannot protect us. We have nothing to do with incitement. We try to deliver the message of the simple people in need to the officials. We try to be the voice of the voiceless, and that is why we keep getting attacked and harassed. 3 days after the post was published, PA forces showed up to arrest Kouazmi. Hearing of the arrest, Amro took to social media himself to condemn the detention. He called for the media to put a social focus on Kouazmi's arrest and suggested an official complaint against the PA be taken to the Europeans. A journalist was threatened by members of security forces on the back of the news of the arrest of Ayman al-Kouazmi, part of Amro's post read. I'm asking all journalists to publish the news. It's not a rumor, it's true news. Secondly, if any journalist is facing the same situation, please talk or get in touch with me. We are going to document all violations of the law and tell the Europeans about it. According to a press release published by Amro's organization, Youth Against Settlements, he was initially called in for an interview with the PA over the post, but was subsequently arrested during the meeting. Locals seem to think the threat of taking the case abroad was the red line Amro crossed in the eyes of the PA. Amro, a very well-connected activist based in Hebron, has given speeches on behalf of Palestine, the United Nations, and other well-respected international institutions. Immediately after Amro's arrest, Amnesty International published a press release calling for the PA to immediately and unconditionally release Amro. It is outrageous that a prominent human rights defender has been arrested simply for voicing his opinion online. Criticizing the authorities should not be a criminal offense. Issa Amro's arrest is the latest evidence that the Palestinian authorities are determined to continue with their repressive campaign against free speech. Magdalena Mughrabi, Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa at Amnesty International, said, "We have seen an alarming escalation in the Palestinian authorities' clampdown on freedom of expression in recent months. Instead of continuing to set up their efforts to quash dissenting voices, the Palestinian Authority should immediately and unconditionally release Issa Amro and stop harassing and intimidating activists and others for daring to speak their minds freely. Mughrabi continued, referring to the escalating crackdown on freedom of speech and press under the PA. In July, via presidential decree, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas passed the Electronic Crimes Law, which law allows for heavy fines and detentions of anyone critical of the Palestinian Authority online, including journalists and whistleblowers. Amnesty documented that the law is also open to be used against regular citizens posting on social media or simply retweeting news or the posts of others. Under the new law, anyone charged with breaking the legislation by posting something that could be deemed a disturbance to public order, national unity, or social peace could be sentenced to imprisonment and up to 15 years hard labor, according to Amnesty. According to the Palestinian Center for Development and Media Freedoms, MADA, the law is a flagrant violation of the principle of the right to privacy, promised by Palestinian Basic Law 32, which guarantees that any violation of any personal freedom, of the sanctity of the private life of human beings, or any of the rights or liberties that have been guaranteed by law or by this basic law shall be considered a crime. In addition, Palestine has agreed to the terms of several international conventions which guarantee and protect freedom of opinion and expression, of which the Electronic Crimes Law is in violation, foremost of which is the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, according to MADA. Due to these facts, MADA, similar to AMRO, called for member states of the convention to take all legislative and other measures in line with international standards against the new law, as well as the Palestinian authorities' actions. In July, at least 10 journalists were summoned by the PA for interrogation, while in August, they arrested at least 6 journalists. In addition, the PA has closed down or blocked access to at least 29 websites, most of which are the websites of news publications. In addition to Gwasme's criticism against the PA that sparked the arrests of himself and Amro, Gwasme also blasted Israel for closing the radio station, a common practice by Israeli forces who have closed down more than a dozen news agencies, publishers, and radio stations since its crackdown on incitement started in the fall of 2015. We are not surprised by his savage behavior of the Israeli army and its collaborators. They want to silence us. They are all conspiring against us, he wrote, prior to his arrest by the PA. If helping the people and aiding them is considered incitement, then we are proud of it. Our main role is to deliver the message and appeals of the ordinary people to the officials. As for incitement, let them show us one instance of incitement. All our programming is archived, and we have nothing to hide. That was an account of the collaboration of the Palestinian Authority with the Israeli military in the subjugation of the media through the arrest of Palestinian activist and voice of the people, Issa Amro. And now on to our feature presentation, which today is Telesure's Abby Martin's interview of journalist Max Blumenthal. We often turn to Max Blumenthal on This Week in Palestine because of all the journalists in the Western media, Max Blumenthal has the best credentials to report on what is happening in Palestine and Israel. His book, Goliath, is a vivid and disturbing account of life in Israel, and his account on the 51-day war in Gaza
reflect the time spent in each place and the integrity of his resources. Here is Max Blumenthal, recently interviewed by Abby Martin on Telesure's Empire Files.
Today I'm sitting down with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist and commentator on Israel and the struggle in Palestine. He's the author of the award-winning book Goliath and the recently published expose, The 51-Day War, where his on-the-ground reporting in Gaza in the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge documented the harrowing reality of Israel's war crimes. I wanted to find out what he discovered during his coverage of the war and how it relates to the current uprising in Palestine. Max, can you break down what's happening right now and what people are calling the Third Intifada?
It doesn't fit within the parameters of what we know an intifada to be, which is a nationwide uprising directed by political factions. What we're seeing is a completely disorganized rebellion by a generation of youth who've grown up after the Oslo Accords, which laid the basis for a two-state solution and the U.S.-led peace process was established. And they've grown up in that reality. It's a reality of separation, exclusion. They've witnessed the destruction of the Palestinian grassroots. All of the institutions of Palestinian life, especially in East Jerusalem, have been virtually eliminated. In the West Bank, they've been folded into the PA and the NGO infrastructure. And they've seen very little opportunity or hope. The occupation has deepened and tightened. They watched a 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip and felt helpless. They've seen the Palestinian de facto leadership in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, coordinate security with their occupier and sick their Palestinian forces on them, carrying out raids, for example, at Bir Zeit University. And so this generation has decided to act on its own. This has been building for a long time. But now that this generation has come of age, they're lashing out at their occupier. They're going out and demonstrating at the friction points of occupation. So, for example, at the checkpoint at Beit El in Al Bire outside Ramallah, there are regular demonstrations. They're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at heavily armed soldiers. Around Nablus, which is a site of settler terror, and especially in Hebron, where settlers, the most radical settlers in all of Israel-Palestine, are embedded in the old city and regularly terrorize and prey on Palestinians. They are carrying out attacks. There are knife attacks inside the Green Line, which is a symbolic act. And what they're doing is they're sending a message that as long as we're occupied, there's going to be a price. You're not going to be safe, and you won't be normal. As Netanyahu said recently, we are destined to live by the sword. But in Tel Aviv, in Haifa, and all of the cities inside Israel's interior where most of the Jewish population lives, it will be like we're in Europe. Or as Ehud Barak, former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, said, we'll be a villa in the jungle. And when young Palestinians enter the villa with knives or with rocks or whatever they have, they are reminding Israelis, you're not a villa in the jungle. You're the jungle in our villa. You're in the Middle East, and you can't just put up a wall and pretend we're not here.
Why is the Al-Aqsa Mosque center to this political struggle?
First of all, Jerusalem has been separated from the West Bank and Ramallah under the thanks to the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords provided the basis for a separation regime. The separation regime was manifested in the separation wall, which separates occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank. The Israelis proceeded to destroy all of the key Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, like Orient House, which was supposed to be the future seat of a Palestinian government that would govern from the capital of East Jerusalem. That all moved to the other side of the wall, to Ramallah. And then every other institution proceeded to collapse. The only thing left was the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the symbol of Palestinian nationalism in Jerusalem. To me, it's much more about the Palestinian national struggle than about religion. But in Israeli society, you've seen in Jewish Israeli society a development where religious nationalist class has risen in power. They're really reorienting society into a theocratic dominionist direction. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a symbol because it's the Temple Mount. There were supposedly Jewish temples there 1,300 years ago, and they aim to rebuild the temple as a symbol of the replacement of Israel as a state governed by civil law with a more theocratic, openly Jewish state, what I would call JSIL, or the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. The Knesset and many of the ministers in Netanyahu's government are religious nationalists. The pressure on Al-Aqsa increases, and the pressure on Jerusalem increases, and the conflict, such as it is, takes on a religious dimension and begins to resemble a clash of civilizations instead of a struggle over rights and land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been almost completely encircled by Israeli settlers, and they've accomplished that through brute force, throwing Palestinians out of their home and replacing them with religious ultra-nationalists. They've built tunnels under Al-Aqsa Mosque, which actually have destabilized the infrastructural integrity of the old city of Jerusalem. And now they're beginning to prevent Palestinians from praying at Al-Aqsa for the first time so that Jewish religious extremists can ascend and conduct their own kind of prayers. And so all of these disruptions have destabilized Jerusalem. Then you have 300,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem living under occupation with constant pressure from settlers. They're living among the most extreme elements of Israeli society who are armed. They themselves are not armed. The youth have been traumatized by this environment, and they're lashing out. And the friction point is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, Al-Aqsa Mosque was where the Second Intifada began, when Ariel Sharon ascended with his surrounded by security forces, and it led to a complete bloodbath.
Well, the siege on Gaza no doubt plays a role in the anger throughout all of Palestine. Max, you were on the ground, and you outlined some harrowing details in your book about what you found. Outline the devastation that took place during last year's 51-day war.
I immediately, as soon as I entered Gaza, went to Shajaiya, which was you couldn't really call it a neighborhood. It's more like an entire city east of Gaza City that had been wiped off the map by Israeli artillery and pretty much every mode of destruction available to the Israelis. Every house I went to there, they weren't really houses, they were ruins of homes, and speaking to elderly women and entire families about having their family members summarily executed in front of them, interviewing paramedics who found a woman, an 80-year-old woman, in a chicken coop who had hid there for 8 days living off of chicken feed, pulling dead families, entire families out of homes, and finding that they couldn't pull them out because their limbs would fall off, and having to bring in bulldozers to bulldoze bodies into mass graves, interviewing the Rujela family about fleeing tank fire and leaving their severely disabled daughter on the road in her wheelchair, and then finding her in her wheelchair a week later riddled with bullets. These kind of stories were what I heard day after day. I mean, everywhere I went, I was walking through a real-life horror film, and this was the Palestinian experience in Gaza for 51 days. It was like a sequel to the movie Saw. How do you deal with that psychologically? That's the question we have to ask now, because the humanitarian situation is worse than it's ever been in history. The United Nations Relief Works Agency predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, and it's currently uninhabitable. People are trapped there. Most can't leave. And who are the Jewish Israelis, the 300,000 who participated in this operation? How do they think? Netanyahu was reelected in a surprise to a lot of Americans after Operation Protective Edge. You have to go into a very right-wing eliminationist mindset in order to justify what you did, and it's Netanyahu is able to cater to that. Just the amount of violence I witnessed was only the beginning of a nightmare that's continuing through the present. The Gaza Strip has 80% of the residents of the Gaza Strip, 72 to 80% are refugees. So it's a warehouse for surplus humans. And for the first time, you actually are seeing, for example, a wave of child suicides. I interviewed the father of Salem Shamali, who was killed on camera.
Guys, this one.
In the hand.
He was looking for his wounded cousin, and he was killed.
Allah. Yalla, yalla, yalla. Shahadu an la ilaha illallah. Allah.
It was reported on by international news, and the family, it really affected the family to find out, you know, our son was killed, and we found out because someone emailed us the video of his killing, and we only knew it was him because we recognized the sound of his screams. So Salem's father told me that his other sons are and children are making amanat, which is a unique term that doesn't really have a clear English translation, but it means like their last dying wishes. So the violence, of course, is on, you know, it's a physical violence, but there's a psychological component to it. The Israelis threatened to bomb the main hospital, the Al-Najjar hospital in Rafah, and so everyone had to pour out of the hospital, wounded people, people missing limbs, and the entire medical staff, and the only place left was the Kuwaiti hospital, which is actually a 20-bed OBGYN and geriatric clinic in the center of town that's completely unequipped for this kind of disaster. And the doctor I met there, Samir Holmes, told me that he was treating amputees on the floor, that his own medical staff was coming in dead, and that the carnage got so bad that he had to order ice cream coolers from local shops to store the corpses of infants. And this image that is widely available of four infants in white death shrouds in an ice cream cooler, I think is iconic. It's the image that distills the entire sensibility of Israeli society at this point and how little value they place on Palestinian life.
And as Israeli forces were using the Hannibal directive and kind of indiscriminately shooting even on their captured soldiers, Al-Qassam Brigade was changing its tactics over the last couple of years. We saw it act pretty differently during the 51-day war. Talk about what happened there.
The tactics of Al-Qassam as a guerrilla force in face-to-face confrontations with Israeli soldiers was untested, and the Israeli military underestimated their capacity. Through the tunnel network in the south of Gaza, the Al-Qassam brigades and Hamas had been able to import some heavy weaponry, like the kind of weapons that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon had. I mean, Cornet anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, lots of AK-47s, and you know, some heavier machine guns that could be carried. But more importantly, the Al-Qassam brigades imported the tactics of Hezbollah. They may have received some Syrian training or indirect Syrian training through Hezbollah. And this proved very effective when the Israeli military invaded in July the neighborhood of Shuja'iyah. You saw basically local teams of fighters situate themselves in tunnels in and around Shuja'iyah and then wait to ambush Israeli soldiers who had initially entered in very lightly armored vehicles, which were supplied by the U.S. military as surplus and were left over from the Vietnam era. And some Qassam sapper teams were able to destroy these vehicles by simply planting charges on them by hand, explosive charges by hand, displaying a lot of bravado. But the most important tactic, I think, that was put on display in Shuja'iyah was the willingness to engage Israeli troops at less than 15 meters away for prolonged periods of time. During Casled in 2008-2009, Al-Qassam would stage hit-and-run attacks, and they learned from Hezbollah that you don't hit and run, you stay in the fight, because that neutralizes the two strengths that Israel has over every other military in the Middle East, air power and artillery power. If you have soldiers engaged in face-to-face fighting, you can't provide air support or artillery support because you'll kill them. The Israeli military founded, this is the Golani Brigade, its most elite special forces, who have very little experience, actually, in real fighting really motivated, well-armed forces. I mean, they're more used to beating up on farmers and stone-throwing kids in the West Bank. They found themselves losing their lives at an alarming rate. Injuries were coming in by the dozens. And I think it was the night of July 14th. I might be getting the date wrong. They decided to retreat and carry out one of the most cowardly military maneuvers in modern military history. Retreat in armored personnel carriers as fast as they could to the border of Israel and Gaza, and then unload with what amounted to half of the artillery pieces in the Israeli military and blanket the entire area with 120 and 155 millimeter howitzers. And that's what resulted in the destruction of Shuja'iyah, was actually the defeat, or the moral defeat, of the Israeli military. The most famous operation was at Nahal Oz. This was later on in July. A team of Al-Qassam fighters with GoPro cameras attached to their helmets attacked an Israeli military base. The goal was to capture soldiers, I think, which would have been a game changer, would have given them a lot of leverage in negotiations, might have even ended the war. But they managed to kill almost every soldier they encountered. They lost only one member of their team and made it back into the tunnel with one of the soldiers' rifles, which was upheld as a trophy at the end of the war. This operation demonstrated, or had two effects. One was it demonstrated that the Al-Qassam brigades aren't interested in attacking civilians, because Nahal Oz is also, the base is part of a kibbutz. I mean, they could have gone and killed civilians, but they chose to engage soldiers. And Al-Qassam General Commander Mohammed Deif stated clearly that we are attacking soldiers while you bring the roofs down on the heads of our civilians. And the second effect it had was securing almost unanimous support in Palestinian society, including among, you know, Fatawi, you know, Fatah supporting people in Ramallah, for the concept of armed resistance. You're used to seeing your relatives and your friends and even experiencing yourself humiliation at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially if you live in Jerusalem or one of the areas where settlers are. And for the first time, you see young Palestinian guys dressed up like commandos giving the Israeli military a bloody nose and taking the fight to the enemy. I mean, that had a strong psychological impact in Palestinian society. And so now there's a lot of criticism of Hamas, dissent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. But I don't know anyone who would question the importance of maintaining a kind of guerrilla force that's highly militarized and is there to fight the Israeli military.
The Israeli parliament has approved a law that imposes stiff penalties on people convicted of throwing rocks at moving vehicles. Under the law, stone throwers could face 10 years in prison and up to 20 years if it is determined that they intended to seriously harm the occupants in a vehicle. The lawmaker who sponsored the legislation said that one-third of arrests in Jerusalem are connected to stone throwing.
So the government's going to great lengths to crush resistance there. The latest measure is the 20-year prison sentence for anyone throwing a stone. Max, talk about the significance of stones in Palestine and why you think this law was passed.
In this case, this law was passed by the Israeli parliament, a very extreme law, and members of the Labor Party and the opposition supported it. It wasn't just right-wingers who were determined to throw young people in jail for almost their entire adult life for throwing a stone. It shows how threatened Israeli society is by the smallest, most minuscule iterations of Palestinian resistance, even symbolic resistance like stones. And now it's become a symbol of resistance and telling Israelis that they're not welcome. You know, why are you throwing rocks at a soldier who's wearing a Kevlar vest and is protected against, you know, 7.62 millimeter live rounds? The Israelis are responding now with unprecedented measures. I went to the hospital in Ramallah in July and interviewed a doctor who told me that he was treating dozens of gunshot wounds to the legs, and that Israel had a shoot-to-cripple policy. And he provided me with documentation, which pretty much showed that soldiers were cracking down on demonstrations with live fire to the legs. Not only that, but some of the bullets were what Palestinians call ton-ton bullets or dum-dum bullets, which are expanding rounds. So they'll bounce around inside your limbs and expand and really cripple you for life. The Israeli... this bill to jail stone throwers for 20 years is complements another measure put into place by the Israeli military and police, which allows even members of the Israeli police to shoot demonstrators with 22 caliber rounds from Ruger rifles. The 22 caliber rounds are less likely to kill, they're more likely to cripple, they shatter bones, they often bounce around inside your body. This is standard practice now. Standard practice to shoot demonstrators with live weapons.
The Palestinian, unfortunately, instead of building a Gaza Strip as the Singapore of the Middle East, they choose the terror path.
They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can, because somebody said they use, I mean, it's gruesome, they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the more dead, the better.
In the letter, and I'll read it to you, you say the formerly populated areas will be shelled in Gaza with maximum firepower. The entire civilian and military infrastructure of Hamas will be destroyed entirely. And then you say those who insist on staying will be required to publicly sign a declaration of loyalty to Israel.
People might be surprised to learn that Netanyahu is actually not the most right-wing in Israeli government, that it's actually just gotten more and more right-wing over the last decade.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I've been saying for the last 2 years, exists at the hollow center of Israeli politics. You know, I talked about the generation of Palestinian youth, the post-Oslo generation, and how they've developed. But within Israeli society, there's been a parallel development with the post-Oslo generation that's extremely radical, sees no hope for, you know, a two-state solution or a peace process. Their approach to the Palestinians is that there's no partner for peace and that they only understand force. This is a generation that's adopted a very strongly Jewish identity, and a belligerent Jewish identity, as opposed to the identity of Israel's founding generation, which was based around a concept of Israeli nationalism, which was racist, but which allowed for some place for Palestinians or Arabs. The kind of sensibility and identity this generation has adopted leaves no place for anyone who's a non-Jew. And this generation is embodied by the current justice minister, Ayelet Shaked. That bill we talked about to punish stone throwers for 20 years, that was her baby. She ushered it through the Knesset. She's young. I think she's, you know, she's our age. She's very telegenic. She's very popular in Israeli society. She's not a settler. She comes from a core Israeli city. In many ways, she's kind of a carpetbagger. And she is genocidal in her approach to Palestinians. In fact, she called for genocide during Operation Protective Edge, for exterminating Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. She's in charge of the Justice Ministry. And you look at the direction of Israeli society. You just look at the polls from Israeli Democracy Institute that show that a majority of youth state their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab or a non-Jew, that a majority of youth favor a kind of one-state apartheid solution. In 2011, in this poll, a plurality of Israelis stated their support for placing Arab citizens of the State of Israel in internment camps during wartime. Three-quarters of Israelis in a recent poll reported by the Times of Israel, three-quarters of religious nationalist Israelis, declared their support for the full ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel who are Palestinian citizens. And 80% said that they boycott Arab businesses. So you look at the direction of Israeli society and you have to conclude that there's no hope for change from within. That those of us on the outside who want to see a different outcome than perpetual conflict can't work from inside Israeli society. We don't have a place for convincing people. There has to be pressure from the outside. And the pressure has to start here because it's Washington and the U.S. government that has funded radicalization in Israel. They've paid for this whole project because every time Israel builds settlements, every time they give money to the settlers, every time the education ministry brings kids to Hebron to see the settlements, every time that they decide to teach kindergartners about the Holocaust and scare kindergartners into an authoritarian mindset, and every time they assault Gaza and get as much time as they want, the U.S. is there to pay for the whole project and to rearm them. And so they're rewarding radicalism in Jewish Israeli society, and that's really ultimately why this trend is continuing.
That was journalist Max Blumenthal, interviewed by Abby Martin on Telesure. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To hear the program later in the day, we realize that 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is awfully early for some, or to listen at any other time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.